length Ludlow Baptist Church poked through one canopy of old elms, and to the right he could see the square brick sturdiness of Ellie's school. Overhead, white clouds moved slowly toward a horizon the color of faded denim, and everywhere were the late summer fields, used up at the end of the cycle, dormant but not dead, an incredible tawny color. "Gorgeous is the right word," Lewis said finally.
"They used to call it Prospect Hill back in the old days," Judd said.
He put a cigarette in the corner of his mouth but did not light it.
"There's a few that still do, but now that younger people have moved into town, it's mostly been forgot. I don't think there's very many people that even come up here. It don't look like you could see much because the hill's not very high, but you can see..."
He gestured with one hand and fell silent. "You can see everything," Rachel said in a low, awed voice. She turned to Lewis. "Honey, do we own this?" And before Lewis could answer, Judd said,
"It's part of the property, oh yes."
Which wasn't, Lewis thought, quite the same thing. It was cooler in the woods, perhaps by as much as 8 or 10 degrees. The path, still wide and occasionally marked with flowers and pots or in coffee cans, most of them wilted, was now floored with dry pine needles. They had gone about a quarter of a mile, moving downhill now, when Judd called Ellie back.
"This is a good walk for a little girl," Judd said kindly, "but I want you to promise your mom and dad that if you come up here, you'll always stay on the path."
"I promise," Ellie said promptly. "Why?"
He glanced at Lewis, who had stopped to rest. Toting Gage, even in the shade of these old pines and spruces, was heavy work.
"Do you know where you are?" Judd asked Lewis.
Lewis considered and rejected answers. "Ludlow, North Ludlow, behind my house, between Route 15 and Middle Drive." He shook his head. Judd jerked a thumb back over his shoulder.
"Plenty of stuff that way," he said. "That's town. This way, nothing but woods for 50 miles or more. The North Ludlow Woods, they call it here, but it hits a little corner of Orrington, then goes over to Rockford. Ends up going on to those state lands I told you about, the one the Indians want back. I know it sounds funny to say your nice little house there on the main road with its phone and electric lights and cable TV and all is on the edge of a wilderness, but it is."
He looked back at Ellie.
"All I'm saying is that you don't want to get messing around in these woods, Ellie. You might lose the path, and God knows where you might end up then."
"I won't, Mr. Crandall."
Ellie was suitably impressed, even awed, but not afraid, Lewis saw. Rachel, however, was looking at Judd uneasily, and Lewis felt a little uneasy himself. It was, he supposed, the city-bred's almost instinctive fear of the woods. Lewis hadn't held a compass in his hand since Boy Scouts 20 years before, and his memories of how to find your way by things like the North Star, or which side of the trees moss grew on, were as vague as his memories of how to tie a sheepshank or a half-hitch. Judd looked them over and smiled a little.
"Now, we ain't lost nobody in these woods since 1934, he said. "At least nobody local. The last one was Will Jepson. No great loss. Except for Stanny Bouchard, I guess Will was the biggest tosspot this side of Bucksport."
"You said nobody local,"
Rachel remarked in a voice that was not quite casual, and Lewis could almost read her mind. "We're not local. At least not yet." Judd paused and then nodded.
"We do lose one of the tourists every 2 or 3 years because they think you can't get lost right off the main road. But we never lost even one of them for good, missus. Don't you fret."
"Are there moose?"
Rachel asked apprehensively, and Lewis smiled. If Rachel wanted to fret, she would jolly well fret.
"Well, you might see a moose," Judd said, "but he wouldn't give you any trouble, Rachel. During mating season, they get a little irritated, but otherwise they do no more than look. Only people they take after out of their rutting time are people from Massachusetts. I don't know why that's so, but it is."
Lewis thought the man was joking, but could not be sure. Judd looked utterly serious.
"I've seen it time and time again. Some fella from Saugus or Milton or Weston up a tree, yelling about a herd of moose, every damn one of 'em as big as a motor home. Seems like moose can smell Massachusetts on a man or a woman. Or maybe it's just all those new clothes from L.L. Bean's they smell. I don't know. I'd like to see one of those animal husbandry students from the college do a paper on it, but I suppose none ever will."
"What's rutting time?" Ellie asked. "Never mind," Rachel said. "I don't want you up here unless you're with a grown-up, Ellie."
Rachel moved a step closer to Lewis. Judd looked pained.
"I didn't want to scare you, Rachel, you or your daughter. No need to be scared in these woods. This is a good path. It gets a little buggy in the spring, and it's a little sloppy all the time, except for 55, which was the driest summer I can remember. But hell, there isn't even any poison ivy or poison oak, which there is at the back of the schoolyard, and you want to stay away from it, Ellie, if you don't want to spend 3 weeks of your life taking starch baths."
Ellie covered her mouth and giggled.
"It's a safe path,"
Judd said earnestly to Rachel, who still didn't look convinced.
"Why, I bet even Gage could follow it. And the town kids come up here a lot, I already told you that. They keep it nice. Nobody tells them to. They just do it. I wouldn't want to spoil that for Ellie."
He bent over her and winked.
"It's like many other things in life, Ellie. You keep on the path and all's well. You get off it, and the next thing you know, you're lost, if you're not lucky. And then someone has to send out a searching party."
They walked on. Lewis began to get a dull cramp of pain in his back from the baby carrier. Every now and then, Gage would grab a double handful of his hair and tug enthusiastically, or administer a cheerful kick to Lewis's kidneys. Late mosquitoes cruised around his face and neck, making their eye-watering hum. The path curved down, bending in and out between very old firs, and then cut widely through a brambly, tangled patch of undergrowth. The going was soupy here, and Lewis's boots squelched in mud and some standing water. At one point they stepped over a marshy spot using a pair of good-sized tussocks as stepping stones. That was the worst of it. They started to climb again, and the trees reasserted themselves. Gage seemed to have magically put on 10 pounds, and the day had, with some similar magic, warmed up 10 degrees. Sweat poured down Lewis's face.
"How you doing, hon?" Rachel asked. "Want me to carry him for a while?"
"No, I'm fine," he said, and it was true, although his heart was larruping along at a good speed in his chest.
He was more used to prescribing physical exercise than he was to doing it. Judd was walking with Ellie by his side. Her lemon-yellow slacks and red blouse were bright splashes of color in the shady brown-green gloom.
"Lou, does he really know where he's going, do you think?"
Rachel asked in a low, slightly worried tone.
"Sure," Lewis said. Judd called back cheerily over his shoulder. "Not much farther now. You bearing up, Lewis?"
My God, Lewis thought. The man's well past 80, but I don't think he's even broken a sweat.
"I'm fine," he called back a little aggressively.
Pride probably would have let him say the same thing even if he had felt the onset of a coronary. He grinned, hitched the straps of the jerry pack up a bit, and went on. They topped the second hill, and then the path sloped through a head-high swatch of bushes and tangled underbrush. It narrowed, and then, just ahead, Lewis saw Ellie and Judd go under an arch made of old, weather-stained boards. Written on these in faded black paint, only just legible, were the words, "Pet Cemetery." He and Rachel exchanged an amused glance and stepped under the arch, instinctively reaching out and grasping each other's hands as they did so, as if they had come here to be married. For the second time that morning, Lewis was surprised into wonder. There was no carpet of needles here. Here was an almost perfect circle of mown grass, perhaps as large as 40 feet in diameter. It was bounded by thickly interlaced underbrush on three sides, and an old blowdown on the fourth, a jackstraw jumble of fallen trees that looked both sinister and dangerous. A man trying to pick his way through that or to climb over it would do well to put on a steel jock, Lewis thought. The clearing was crowded with markers, obviously made by children from whatever materials they could beg or borrow, the slats of crates, scrap wood, pieces of beaten tin. And yet, seen against the perimeter of low bushes and straggly trees that fought for living space and sunlight here, the very fact of their clumsy manufacture and the fact that humans were responsible for what was here seemed to emphasize what symmetry they had. The forested backdrop lent the place a crazy sort of profundity, a charm that was not Christian but pagan. "It's lovely," Rachel said, not sounding as if she meant it.
"Wow!" Ellie cried.
Lewis unshouldered Gage and pulled him out of the baby carrier so he could crawl. Lewis's back sighed with relief. Ellie ran from one monument to the next, exclaiming over each. Lewis followed her while Rachel kept an eye on the baby. Judd sat down cross-legged, his back against a protruding rock, and smoked. Lewis noticed that the place did not just seem to have a sense of order, a pattern. The memorials had been arranged in rough concentric circles. "Smucky the cat," one crate board marker proclaimed. The hand was childish but careful. He was obedient. And below this, 1971 to 1974. A little way around the outer circle, he came to a piece of natural slate with a name written on it in fading but perfectly legible red paint. Biffer. And below this, a bit of verse. "Biffer, biffer, a hell of a sniffer. Until he died, he made us richer."
"Biffer was the deathless cocker spaniel," Judd said.
He had dug a bald place in the earth with the heel of his shoe and was carefully tapping all his ashes into it.
"Got run over by a dumpster last year. Ain't that some poem?"
"It sure is," Lewis agreed. Some of the graves were marked with flowers, some fresh, most old, not a few almost totally decomposed. Over half of the painted and penciled inscriptions that Lewis tried to read had faded away to partial or total illegibility. Others bore no discernible mark at all, and Lewis guessed that the writing on these might have been done with chalk or crayon.
"Mom!" Ellie yelled. "Here's a goldfishy! Come and see!"
"I'll pass," Rachel said, and Lewis glanced at her. She was standing by herself outside the outermost circle, looking more uncomfortable than ever. Lewis thought, even here she's upset. She never had been easy around the appearances of death. Not, he supposed, that anyone really was. Probably because of her sister. Rachel's sister had died very young, and it had left a scar which Lewis had learned early in their marriage not to touch. Her name had been Zelda, and her death had been from spinal meningitis. Her mortal illness had probably been long and painful and ugly, and Rachel would have been in an impressionable age. If she wanted to forget it, he thought there could be no harm in that. Lewis tipped her a wink, and Rachel smiled gratefully at him. Lewis looked up. They were in a natural clearing. He supposed that explained how well the grass did. The sun could get through. Nevertheless, it would have taken watering and careful tending. That meant cans of water lugged up here, or maybe Indian pumps even heavier than Gage and his jerry pack carried on small backs. He thought again that it was an odd thing for children to have kept up for so long. His own memory of childhood enthusiasms, reinforced by his dealings with Ellie, was that they tended to burn like newsprint. Fast, hot, and quick to die. Moving inward, the pet graves became older. Fewer and fewer of the inscriptions could be read, but those that could yielded a rough timeline extending into the past. Here was Trixie, kilt on the highway, September 15, 1968. In the same circle was a wide, flat board planted deep in the earth, Frost and thaw had warped it and canted it to one side, but Lewis could still make out, "In memory of Marta, our pet rabbit, died March 1st, 1965. A row farther in was General Patton, our good dog, the inscription amplified, who had died in 1958. And Polynesia, who would have been a parrot if Lewis remembered his Dr. Doolittle correctly, who had squawked her last Pollywanna cracker in the summer of 1953. There was nothing readable in the next two rows, and then, still a long way in from the center, chiseled roughly on a piece of sandstone, was Hannah the Best Dog That Ever Lived, 1929 to 1939. Although sandstone was relatively soft, as a result the inscription was now little more than a ghost, Lewis found it hard to conceive of the hours some child must have spent impressing those 9 words on the stone. The commitment of love and grief seemed to him staggering. This was something parents did not even do for their own parents, or for their children if they died young. "Boy, this does go back some," he said to Judd, who had strolled over to join him. Judd nodded. "Come here, Lewis. I want to show you something." They walked to a row only 3 back from the center. Here the circular pattern, perceived as an almost haphazard coincidence in the outer rows, was very evident. Judd stopped before a small piece of slate that had fallen over. Kneeling carefully, the old man set it up again.
"Used to be words here," Judd said. "I chiseled them myself, but it's worn away now. I buried my first dog here, Spot. He died of old age in 1914. The year the Great War begun."
Bemused by the thought that here was a graveyard that went farther back than many graveyards for people, Lewis walked toward the center and examined several of the markers. None of them were readable, and most had been almost reclaimed by the forest floor. The grass had almost entirely overgrown one, and when he set it back up, there was a small tearing, protesting sound from the earth. Blind beetles scurried over the section he had exposed. He felt a small chill and thought, "Boot Hill for animals. I'm not sure I really like it." How far do these go back?
"Gory, I don't know," Judd said, putting his hands deep in his pockets. "Place was here when Spot died, of course. I had a whole gang of friends in those days. They helped me dig the hole for Spot. Digging here ain't that easy, either. Ground's awful stony, you know, hard to turn. And I help them sometimes." He pointed here and there with a horny finger. "That was Pete Lavasse's dog, if I remember right. And there's 3 of Albion Groatley's bond cats buried right in a row there. Old man Fritchie kept racing pigeons. Me and Al Groatley and Carl Hanna buried one of them that a dog got. He's right there." He paused thoughtfully. "I'm the last of that bunch left, you know. All dead now, my gang. All gone." Lewis said nothing, only stood looking at the pet graves with his hands in his pockets. "Ground stony," Judd repeated. "Couldn't plant nothing here but corpses anyway, I guess." Across the way, Gage began to cry thinly, and Rachel brought him over, toting him on her hip.
"He's hungry," she said. "I think we ought to go back, Lou."
"Please, okay?" her eyes asked.
"Sure," he said. He shouldered the jerry pack again and turned around so Rachel could pop Gage in.
"Ellie? Hey, Ellie, where are you?"
"There she is," Rachel said and pointed toward the blowdown. Ellie was climbing as if the blowdown was a bastard cousin to the monkey bars at school.
"Oh, honey, you want to come down off there?" Judd called over, alarmed. "You stick your foot in the wrong hole and those old trees shift. You'll break your ankle."
Ellie jumped down.
"Ow!"
she cried and came toward them, rubbing her hip. The skin wasn't broken, but a stiff, dead branch had torn her slacks.
"You see what I mean?" Judd said, ruffling her hair. "Old blowdown like this, even someone wise about the woods won't try to climb over it if he can go around. Trees that all fall down in a pile get mean. They'll bite you if they can." Really? Ellie asked.
Really. They're piled up like straws, you see, and if you was to step on the right one, they might all come down in an avalanche.
Ellie looked at Lewis. Is that true, Daddy?
I think so, hon.
Yuck.
She looked back at the blowdown and yelled,
You tore my pants, you cruddy trees!
All three of the grown-ups laughed. The blowdown did not. It merely sat whitening in the sun as it had done for decades. To Lewis, it looked like the skeletal remains of some long-dead monster, something slain by a parfait good and genteel knight, perchance. A dragon's bones left here in a giant cairn. It occurred to him even then that there was something too convenient about that blowdown, and the way it stood between the pet cemetery and the depths of woods beyond. Woods which Judd Crandall later sometimes referred to absently as the Indian Woods. Its very randomness seemed too artful, too perfect for a work of nature. Then Gage grabbed one of his ears and twisted it, crowing happily, and Lewis forgot all about the blowdown in the woods beyond the pet cemetery. It was time to go home. 9. Ellie came to him the next day looking troubled. Lewis was working on a model in his study. This one was a 1917 Rolls-Royce Silver Ghost, 680 pieces over 50 moving parts. It was nearly done, and he could almost imagine the liveried chauffeur, direct descendant of 18th and 19th century English coachmen, sitting imperially behind the wheel. He had been model crazy since his 10th year. He had begun with a World War I Spad that his Uncle Carl had brought him, had worked his way through most of the Revell airplanes, and had moved on to bigger and better things in his teens and 20s. There had been a boats and bottles phase, and a war machines phase, and even a phase in which he had built guns so realistic it was hard to believe they wouldn't fire when you pulled the trigger. Colts and Winchesters and Lugers, even a Buntline special. Over the last 5 years or so, it had been the big cruise ships. A model of the Lusitania and one of the Titanic sat on his shelves at his university office, and the Andrea Doria, completed just before they left Chicago, was currently cruising the mantelpiece in their living room. Now he had moved on to classic cars, and if previous patterns held true, he supposed it would be 4 or 5 years before the urge to do something new struck him. Rachel looked on this, his only real hobby, with a wifely indulgence that held, he supposed, some elements of contempt. Even after 10 years of marriage, she probably thought he would grow out of it. Perhaps some of this attitude came from her father, who believed just as much now as at the time Lewis and Rachel had married that he had gotten an asshole for a son-in-law. Maybe, he thought, Rachel is right. Maybe I'll just wake up one morning at the age of 37, put all these models in the attic, and take up hang gliding. Meanwhile, Ellie looked serious. Far away, drifting in the clean air, he could hear that perfect Sunday morning sound of church bells calling worshippers.
Hi, Dad, she said.
Hello, Pumpkin. What's happening?
Oh, nothing, she said,
but her face said differently. Her face said that plenty was up, and none of it was so hot, thank you very much. Her hair was freshly washed and fell loose to her shoulders. In this light, it was still more blonde than the brown it was inevitably becoming. She was wearing a dress, and it occurred to Lewis that his daughter almost always put on a dress on Sundays, although they did not attend church.
What are you building?
Carefully gluing on a mudguard, he told her. Look at this, he said, carefully handing her a hubcap. See those linked R's? That's a nice detail, huh? If we fly back to Chi-Town for Thanksgiving and we get on an L-1011, you look out at the jet engines and you'll see those same R's.
Hubcap, big deal, she handed it back.
Please, he said, if you own a Rolls-Royce, you call that a wheel covering. If you're rich enough to own a Rolls, you can strut a little. When I make my second million, I'm going to buy myself one. Rolls-Royce Corniche. Then when Gage gets carsick, he can throw up into real leather. And just by the way, Ellie, what's on your mind? But it didn't work out that way with Ellie. You didn't ask things right out. She was wary of giving too much of herself away. It was a trait Lewis admired.
Are we rich, Daddy?
No, he said, but we're not going away to starve, either. Michael Burns at school says all doctors are rich. Well, you tell Michael Burns at school that lots of doctors get rich, but it takes 20 years. And you don't get rich running a university infirmary. You get rich being a specialist, a gynecologist, or an orthopedist, or a neurologist. They get rich quicker. For utility infielders like me, it takes longer.
Then why don't you be a specialist, Daddy?
Lewis thought of his models again, and of the way he had one day just not wanted to build any more warplanes. The way he had likewise gotten tired of Tiger tanks and gun emplacements. The way he had come to believe, almost overnight it seemed in retrospect, that building boats and bottles was pretty dumb. And then he thought of what it would be like to spend your whole life inspecting children's feet for hammer toe, or putting on the thin latex gloves so you could grope along some woman's vaginal canal with one educated finger feeling for bumps or lesions. I just wouldn't like it, he said. Church came into the office, paused, inspected the situation with his bright green eyes. He leaped silently onto the windowsill and appeared to go to sleep. Ellie glanced at him and frowned, which struck Lewis as exceedingly odd. Usually Ellie looked at Church with an expression of love so sappy it was almost painful. She began to walk around the office, looking at various models, and in a voice that was nearly casual, she said, "Boy, there were a lot of graves up in the pet cemetery, weren't there?" "Ah, here's the nub," Lewis thought, but did not look around. After examining his instructions, he began putting the carriage lamps on the rolls. "There were," he said. "Better than 100, I'd say."
"Daddy, why don't pets live as long as people?"
"Well, some animals do live about as long," he said, "and some live much longer. Elephants live a very long time, and there are some sea turtles so old that people don't really know how old they are, or maybe they do, and they just can't believe it." Ellie dismissed these simply enough.
"Elephants and sea turtles aren't pets. Pets don't live very long at all. Michael Burns says that every year a dog lives, it's like 9 of our years."
7, Lewis corrected automatically.
"I see what you're getting at, honey, and there's some truth to it. A dog who lives to be 12 is an old dog. See, there's this thing called metabolism, and what metabolism seems to do is tell time. Oh, it does other stuff, too. Some people can eat a lot and stay thin because of their metabolism, like your mother. Other people, me, for instance, just can't eat as much without getting fat. Our metabolisms are different, that's all. But what metabolism seems to do most of all is to serve living things as a body clock. Dogs have a fairly rapid metabolism. The metabolism of human beings is much slower. We live to be about 72, most of us. And believe me, 72 years is a very long time." Because Ellie looked really worried, he hoped he sounded more sincere than he actually felt. He was 35, and it seemed to him that those years had passed as quickly and ephemerally as a momentary draft under a door. "Sea turtles, now, have an even slower metabolism. What about cats?" Ellie asked and looked at Church again.
"Well, cats live as long as dogs," he said. "Mostly, anyway."
This was a lie, and he knew it. Cats lived violent lives and often died bloody deaths, always just below the usual range of human sight. Here was Church, dozing in the sun, or appearing to. Church, who slept peacefully on his daughter's bed every night. Church, who had been so cute as a kitten, all tangled up in a ball of string. And yet Lewis had seen him stalk a bird with a broken wing, his green eyes sparkling with curiosity, and, yes, Lewis would have sworn it, cold delight. He rarely killed what he stalked, but there had been one notable exception, a large rat, probably caught in the alley between their apartment house and the next. Church had really put the blocks to that baby. It had been so bloody and gore-flecked that Rachel, then in her 6th month with Gage, had had to run into the bathroom and vomit. Violent lives, violent deaths. A dog got them and ripped them open instead of just chasing them like the bumbling, easily fooled dogs in the TV cartoons. Or another Tom got them, or a poison bait, or a passing car. Cats were the gangsters of the animal world, living outside the law and often dying there. There were a great many of them who never grew old by the fire. But those were maybe not the things to tell your 5-year-old daughter, who was for the first time examining the facts of death.
I mean, he said, Church is only 3 now, and you're 5. He might still be alive when you're 15, a sophomore in high school, and that's a long time away.
It doesn't seem long to me, Ellie said, and now her voice trembled. Not long at all.
Lewis gave up the pretense of working on his model and gestured for her to come. She sat on his lap, and he was again struck by her beauty, which was emphasized now by her emotional upset. She was dark-skinned, almost Levantine. Tony Benton, one of the doctors he had worked with in Chicago, used to call her the Indian Princess.
Honey, he said, if it was up to me, I'd let Church live to be 100. But I don't make the rules.
Who does? She asked, and then with infinite scorn.
God, I suppose.
Lewis stifled the urge to laugh. It was too serious.
God or somebody, he said.
Clocks run down, that's all I know.
There are no guarantees, babe.
I don't want Church to be like all those dead pets, she burst out, suddenly tearful and furious. I don't want Church to ever be dead. He's my cat, he's not God's cat. Let God have his own cat. Let God have all the damn old cats he wants and kill them all. Church is mine!
There were footsteps across the kitchen and Rachel looked in, startled. Ellie was now weeping against Lewis's chest. The horror had been articulated. It was out. Its face had been drawn and could be regarded. Now, even if it could not be changed, it could at least be wept over.
Ellie, he said, rocking her. Ellie, Ellie. Church isn't dead. He's right over there, sleeping.
But he could be, she wept. He could be any time.
He held her and rocked her, believing, rightly or wrongly, that Ellie wept for the very intractability of death, its imperviousness to argument or to a little girl's tears, that she wept over its cruel unpredictability, and that she wept because of the human being's wonderful, deadly ability to translate symbols into conclusions that were either fine and noble or blackly terrifying. If all those animals had died and been buried, then Church could die.
Any time.
And be buried. And if that could happen to Church, it could happen to her mother, her father, her baby brother, to herself. Death was a vague idea. The pet cemetery was real. In the texture of those rude markers were truths which even a child's hands could feel. It would be easy to lie at this point, the way he had lied earlier about the life expectancy of tomcats. But a lie would be remembered later and perhaps finally totted up on the report card all children hand in to themselves on their parents. His own mother had told him such a lie, an innocuous one about women finding babies in the dewy grass when they really wanted them. And as innocuous as the lie had been, Lewis had never forgiven his mother for telling it, or himself for believing it.
Honey, he said, it happens. It's a part of life. It's a bad part, she cried. It's a really bad part.
There was no answer for this. She wept. Eventually her tears would stop. It was a necessary first step on the way to making an uneasy peace with the truth that was never going to go away. He held his daughter and listened to church bells on Sunday morning, floating across the September fields, and it was some time after her tears had stopped before he realized that, like Church, she had gone to sleep. He put her up in her bed and then came downstairs to the kitchen, where Rachel was beating cake batter too hard. He mentioned his surprise that Ellie should just cork off like that in the middle of the morning. It wasn't like her.
No,
Rachel said, setting the bowl down on the counter with a decisive thump.
It isn't, but I think she was awake most of the night. I heard her tossing around, and Church cried to go out around 3. He only does that when she's restless.
Why would she—
Oh, you know why, Rachel said angrily. That damn pet cemetery is why. It really upset her, Lou. It was the first cemetery of any kind for her, and it just upset her. I don't think I'll write your friend Judd Crandall any thank you notes for that little hike.
All at once he's my friend, Lewis thought, bemused and distressed at the same time.
Rachel, and I don't want her going up there again.
Rachel, what Judd said about the path is true.
It's not the path, and you know it,
Rachel said. She picked up the bowl again and began beating the cake batter even faster.
It's that damn place. It's unhealthy. Kids going up there and tending the graves, keeping the path fucking morbid is what it is. Whatever disease the kids in this town have got, I don't want Ellie to catch it.
Lewis stared at her nonplussed. He more than half suspected that one of the things which had kept their marriage together, when it seemed as if each year brought the news that two or three of their friends' marriages had collapsed, was their respect of the mystery, the half-grasped but never-spoken idea that maybe when you got right down to the place where the cheese binds, there was no such thing as marriage, no such thing as union, that each soul stood alone and ultimately defied rationality. That was the mystery. And no matter how well you thought you knew your partner, you occasionally ran into blank walls or fell into pits. And sometimes, rarely, thank God, you ran into a full-fledged pocket of alien strangeness, something like the clear air turbulence that can buffet an airliner for no reason at all. An attitude or belief which you had never suspected, one so peculiar, at least to you, that it seemed nearly psychotic. And then you trod lightly, if you valued your marriage and your peace of mind. You tried to remember that anger at such a discovery was the province of fools who really believed it was possible for one mind to know another. "Honey, it's just a pet cemetery," he said. "The way she was crying in there just now," Rachel said, gesturing toward the door to his office with a batter-covered spoon. "Do you think it's just a pet cemetery to her? It's going to leave a scar, Lou. No, she's not going up there anymore. It's not the path. It's the place. Here she is already thinking church is going to die." For a moment, Lewis had the crazy impression that he was still talking to Ellie. She had simply donned stilts, one of her mother's dresses, and a very clever, very realistic Rachel mask. Even the expression was the same, set and a bit sullen on top, but wounded beneath. He groped because suddenly the issue seemed large to him, not a thing to be simply passed over in deference to that mystery or that aloneness. He groped because it seemed to him that she was missing something so large it nearly filled the landscape, and you couldn't do that unless you were deliberately closing your eyes to it. "Rachel," he said. "Church is going to die." She stared at him angrily. "That is hardly the point," she said, enunciating each word carefully, speaking as one might speak to a backward child. "Church is not going to die today or tomorrow." "I tried to tell her that, or the day after that, or probably for years." "Honey, we can't be sure of the—"
"Of course we can," she shouted. "We take good care of him. He's not going to die. No one is going to die around here. And so why do you want to go and get a little girl all upset about something she can't understand until she's much older?"
"Rachel, listen." But Rachel had no intention of listening. She was blazing. "It's bad enough to try and cope with a death, a pet or a friend or a relative, when it happens without turning it into a goddamn tourist attraction. A forest lawn for animals." Tears were running down her cheeks. "Rachel," he said, and tried to put his hands on her shoulders. She shrugged them off in a quick, hard gesture. "Never mind," she said. "You don't have the slightest idea what I'm talking about." He sighed.
"I feel like I fell through a hidden trap door and got into a giant mixmaster," he said, hoping for a smile. He got none. Only her eyes locked on his, black and blazing. She was furious, he realized. Not just angry, but absolutely furious.
"Rachel," he said suddenly, not fully sure what he was going to say until it was out, "how did you sleep last night?"
"Oh, boy," she said scornfully, turning away, but not before he had seen a wounded flicker in her eyes. "That's really intelligent, really intelligent. You never change, Lewis. When something isn't going right, blame Rachel, right? Rachel's just having one of her weird emotional reactions. That's not fair."
"No?"
She took the bowl of cake batter over to the far counter by the stove and set it down with another bang. She began to grease a cake tin, her lips pressed tightly together. He said patiently, "There's nothing wrong with a child finding out something about death, Rachel. In fact, I'd call it a necessary thing. Ellie's reaction, her crying, That seemed perfectly natural to me.
Oh, it sounded natural, Rachel said, whirling on him again. It sounded very natural to hear her weeping her heart out over her cat, which is perfectly fine.
Stop it, he said. You're not making any sense. I don't want to discuss it anymore.
Yes, but we're going to, he said, angry himself now. You had your at-bats. How about giving me mine? She's not going up there anymore, and as far as I'm concerned, the subject is closed.
Ellie has known where babies come from since last year, Lewis said deliberately. We got her the Myers book and talked to her about it. Do you remember that? We both agreed that children ought to know where they come from.
That has nothing to do with it. It does, though, he said roughly.
When I was talking to her in my office about church, I got thinking about my mother and how she spun me that old cabbage leaf story when I asked her where women got babies. I've never forgotten that lie. I don't think children ever forget the lies their parents tell them.
Where babies come from has nothing to do with a goddamn pet cemetery, Rachel cried at him.
And what her eyes said to him was, talk about the parallels all night and all day if you want to, Lewis. Talk until you turn blue, but I won't accept it. Still, he tried. She knows about babies. The place up in the woods just made her want to know something about the other end of things. It's perfectly natural. In fact, I think it's the most natural thing in the world.
Will you stop saying that?
She screamed suddenly. Really screamed. And Lewis recoiled, startled. His elbows struck the open bag of flour on the counter. It tumbled off the edge and struck the floor, splitting open. Flour puffed up in a dry white cloud. Oh, fuck, he said dismally. In an upstairs room, Gage began to cry.
That's nice, she said, also crying now. You woke the baby up, too. Thanks for a nice, quiet, stressless Sunday morning.
She started by him, and Lewis put a hand on her arm. Let me ask you something, he said, because I know that anything, literally anything, can happen to physical beings. As a doctor, I know that. Do you want to be the one to explain to her what happened if her cat gets distemper or leukemia? Cats are very prone to leukemia, you know? Or if he gets run over in that road? Do you want to be the one, Rachel?
Let me go,
she nearly hissed. The anger in her voice, however, was overmatched by the hurt and bewildered terror in her eyes. I don't want to talk about this, Lewis, and you can't make me, that look said. Let me go. I want to get Gage before he falls out of his
Because maybe you ought to be the one, he said.
You can tell her we don't talk about it. Nice people don't talk about it. They just bury it.
Oops, but don't say buried. You'll give her a complex. I hate you,
Rachel sobbed and tore away from him. Then he was, of course, sorry. And it was, of course, too late.
Rachel, she pushed by him roughly, crying harder. Leave me alone. You've done enough.
She paused in the kitchen doorway, turning toward him, the tears coursing down her cheeks.
I don't want this discussed in front of Ellie anymore, Lou. I mean it. There's nothing natural about death. Nothing. You, as a doctor, should know that.
She whirled and was gone, leaving Lewis in the empty kitchen, which still vibrated with their voices. At last he went to the pantry to get the broom. As he swept, he reflected on the last thing she had said and on the enormity of this difference of opinion, which had gone undiscovered for so long. Because, as a doctor, he knew that death was, except perhaps for childbirth, the most natural thing in the world. Taxes were not so sure. Human conflicts were not. The conflicts of society were not. Boom and bust were not. In the end, there was only the clock and the markers, which became eroded and nameless in the passage of time. Even sea turtles and the giant sequoias had to buy out someday.
Zelda, he said aloud. Christ, that must have been bad for her.
The question was, should he just let it ride, or should he try to do something about it? He tilted the dustpan over the wastebasket, and flour slid out with a soft foom, powdering the cast-out cartons and used-up cans.
10. Hope Ellie didn't take it too hard, Judd Crandall said.
Not for the first time, Lewis thought that the man had a peculiar, and rather uncomfortable, ability to put his finger gently on whatever the sore spot was. He and Judd and Norma Crandall now sat on the Crandall's porch in the cool of the evening, drinking iced tea instead of beer. On 15, going home after the weekend traffic was fairly heavy. People recognized that every good late summer weekend might now be the last one, Lewis supposed. Tomorrow, he took up his full duties at the University of Maine Infirmary. All day yesterday and today, students had been arriving, filling apartments in Orono and dorms on campus, making beds, renewing acquaintances, and no doubt groaning over another year of 8 o'clock classes and commons food. Rachel had been cool to him all day. No, freezing was more like it. And when he went back across the road tonight, he knew that she would already be in bed, Gage sleeping with her more than likely. The two of them so far over to her side that the baby would be in danger of falling off. His half of the bed would have grown to 3/4, all of it looking like a big, sterile desert.
I said I hoped.
Sorry, Lewis said. Wool gathering. She was a little upset, yeah. How did you guess that?
Seen him come and go, like I said.
Judd took his wife's hand gently and grinned at her.
Haven't we, dear?
Packs and packs of them, Norma Crandall said. We love the children.
Sometimes that pet cemetery is their first eyeball to eyeball with death, Judd said. They see people die on TV, but they know that's pretend. Like the old westerns they used to have at the movies on Saturday afternoons. On TV and in the western movies, they just hold their stomachs or their chests and fall over. Place up on that hill seems a lot more real to most of them than all those movies and TV shows put together, don't you know?
Lewis nodded, thinking, tell my wife that, why don't you?
Some kids it don't affect at all, at least not so you can see it, although I'd guess most of them kind of take it home in their pockets to look over later, like all the other stuff they collect. Most of them are fine, but some... You remember the little Holloway boy, Norma?
She nodded. Ice chattered softly in the glass she held. Her glasses hung on her chest, and the headlights of a passing car illuminated the chain briefly.
He had such nightmares, she said. Dreams about corpses coming out of the ground and I don't know what all. Then his dog died. Ate some poison bait was all anyone in town could figure, wasn't it, Judd?
Poison bait, Judd said, nodding. That's what most people thought, eh? That was 1925. Billy Holloway was maybe 10 then. Went on to become a state senator. Ran for the U.S. House of Representatives later on, but he lost. That was just before Korea.
He and some of his friends had a funeral for the dog, Norma remembered. It was just a mongrel, but he loved it well. I remember his parents were a little against the burying, because of the bad dreams and all, but it went off fine. Two of the bigger boys made a coffin, didn't they, Judd?
Judd nodded and drained his iced tea.
Dean and Dana Hall, he said. Them and that other kid Billy chummed with, I can't remember his first name, but I'm sure he was one of the Bowie kids. You remember the Bowies that used to live up on Middle Drive in the old Brachette house, Norma?
Yes. Norma said, as excited as if it had happened yesterday, and perhaps in her mind it seemed that way. It was a Bowie. Alan or Bert.
Well, maybe it was Kendall, Judd agreed. Anyways, I remember they had a pretty good argument about who was going to be pallbearers. The dog wasn't very big, and so there wasn't room but for two. The Hall boys said they ought to be the ones to do it since they made the coffin. And also because they were twins, sort of a match set, you see. Billy said they didn't know Bowser, that was the dog, well enough to be the pallbearers. My dad says only close friends get to be pallbearers, was his argument. Not just any carpenter.
Judd and Norma both laughed at this, and Lewis grinned.
They was just about ready to fight over it when Mandy Holloway, Billy's sister, fetched out the 4th volume of the Encyclopedia Britannica, Judd said. Her dad, Stephen Holloway, was the only doctor this side of Bangor and that side of Bucksport in those days, Lewis, and they was the only family in Ludlow that could afford a set of encyclopedia.
They were also the first to have electric lights, Norma broke in.
Anyway, Judd resumed, Mandy came all out of flukin', head up and tail over a splashboard, all of 8 years old, petticoats flying, that big book in her arms. Billy and the Bowie kid, I think it must have been Kendall, him that crashed and burned up in Pensacola, where they was training fighter pilots in early 1942, they was getting ready to take on the Hall twins over the privilege of toting that poor old poison mutt up to the boneyard.
Lewis started giggling. Soon he was laughing out loud. He could feel the days-old residue of tension left from the bitter argument with Rachel beginning to loosen.
So she says, "Wait, wait, look at this!" And they all stop and look, and goddamn if she ain't...
"Judd," Norma said warningly.
"Sorry, dear. I get carried away yawning, you know that."
"I guess you do," she said.
"And darned if she ain't got that book open to funerals, and there's a picture of Queen Victoria getting a final send-off and bon voyage, and there are about 40-11 people on each side of her coffin, some sweating and straining to lift a bugger, some just standing around in their funeral coats and ruffled collars like they was waiting for someone to call post-time at the racetrack. And Mandy says, 'When it's a ceremonial funeral of state, you can have as many as you want. The book says so.'"
"That solved it?" Lewis asked.
"That did the trick. They ended up with about 20 kids, and damn if they didn't look just like the picture Mandy had found, except maybe for the ruffles and the tall hats. Mandy took charge, she did, got 'em lined up and gave each of 'em a wild flower, a dandelion or a lady's slipper or a daisy, and off they went. By the gee, I always thought the country missed a bet when Mandy Holloway never got voted to the U.S. Congress." He laughed and shook his head. "Anyway, that was the end of Billy's bad dreams about the pet cemetery. He mourned his dog and finished his mourning and got on, which is what we all do, I guess."
Lewis thought again of Rachel's near hysteria.
"Your Ellie will get over it," Norma said and shifted position. "You must be thinking that death is all we talk about around here, Lewis. Judd and I are getting on, but I hope neither of us has gotten to the gore-crow stage yet."
"No, of course not. Don't be silly," Lewis said.
"But it's not such a bad idea to be on nodding acquaintance with it. These days, I don't know, no one wants to talk about it or think about it, it seems. They took it off the TV because they thought it might hurt the children some way, hurt their minds. And people want closed coffins so they don't have to look at the remains and say goodbye. It just seems like people want to forget it."
"And at the same time, they brought in the cable TV with all those movies showing people..."
Judd looked at Norma and cleared his throat.
"Showing people doing what people usually do with the shades pulled down," he finished. "Queer how things change from one generation to the next, isn't it?"
"Yes," Lewis said. "I suppose it is."
"Well, we come from a different time,"
Judd said, sounding almost apologetic.
"We was on closer terms with death. We saw the flu epidemic after the Great War, mothers dying with child and children dying of infection and fevers that it seems like doctors just wave a magic wand over these days. In the time when me and Norma was young, if you got cancer, why, that was your death warrant right there. No radiation treatments back in the 1920s. Two wars, murders, suicides."
He fell silent for a moment.
"We knew it as a friend and as an enemy," he said finally. "My brother Pete died of a burst appendix in 1912, back when Taft was president. Pete was just 14, and he could hit a baseball farther than any kid in town. In those days, you didn't need to take a course in college to study death, hospice, or whatever they call it. In those days, it came into the house and said howdy, and sometimes it took supper with you, and sometimes you could feel it bite your ass."
This time Norma didn't correct him. Instead, she nodded silently. Lewis stood up, stretched.
"I have to go," he said. "Big day tomorrow."
"Yes, a merry-go-round starts for you tomorrow, don't it?"
Judd said, also standing. Judd saw Norma was also trying to get up and gave her a hand. She rose with a grimace. "Bad tonight, is it?" Lewis asked.
"Not so bad," she said.
"Put some heat on it when you go to bed.
I will,
Norma said.
I always do. And Louis, don't fret about Ellie. She'll be too busy getting to know her new friends this fall to worry much about that old place. Maybe someday all of them will go up and repaint some of the signs or pull weeds or plant flowers. Sometimes they do, when the notion takes them. And she'll feel better about it. She'll start to get that nodding acquaintance.
Not if my wife has anything to say about it.
Come on over tomorrow night and tell me how it went up in the college, if you get the chance, Judd said. I'll whoop you at cribbage.
Well, maybe I'll get you drunk first, Louis said. Double skunk you.
Doc, Judd said with great sincerity, the day I get double skunked at cribbage would be the day I'd let a quack like you treat me.
He left on their laughter and crossed the road to his own house in the late summer dark. Rachel was sleeping with the baby, curled up on her side of the bed in a fetal protective position. He supposed she would get over it. There had been other arguments and times of coldness in their marriage, but this one was surely the worst of the lot. He felt sad and angry and unhappy all at the same time, wanting to make it up but not sure how, not even sure that the first move should come from him. It was also pointless, only a capful of wind somehow blown up to hurricane proportions by a trick of the mind. Other fights and arguments, yes, sure, but only a few as bitter as the one over Ellie's tears and questions. He supposed it didn't take a great many blows like that before the marriage sustained structural damage. And then one day, instead of reading about it in a note from a friend,
well, I suppose I ought to tell you before you hear it from someone else, Lou, Maggie and I are splitting. Or in the newspaper, it was you.
He undressed to his shorts quietly and set the alarm for 6 a.m. Then he showered, washed his hair, shaved, and crunched up a Rolaid before brushing his teeth. Norma's iced tea had given him acid indigestion. Or maybe it was coming home and seeing Rachel all the way over on her side of the bed. Territory is that which defines all else. Hadn't he read that in some college history course? Everything done, the evening put neatly away, he went to bed, but couldn't sleep. There was something else, something that nagged at him. The last 2 days went around and around in his head as he listened to Rachel and Gage breathing nearly in tandem. General Patton. Hannah, the best dog that ever lived. Marta, our pet rabbit. Ellie, furious.
I don't want Church to ever be dead. He's not God's cat. Let God have his own cat.
Rachel, equally furious.
You as a doctor should know.
Norma Crandall saying,
it just seems like people want to forget it.
And Judd, his voice terribly sure, terribly certain, a voice from another age.
Sometimes it took supper with you, and sometimes you could feel it bite your ass.
And that voice merged with the voice of his mother, who had lied to Louis Creed about sex at 4 but told him the truth about death at 12, when his cousin Ruthie had been killed in a stupid car accident. She had been crushed in her father's car by a kid who had found the keys in a public works department payloader and decided to take it for a cruise, and then found out he didn't know how to stop it. The kid suffered only minor cuts and contusions. His uncle Carl's Fairlane was demolished.
She can't be dead, he had replied in answer to his mother's bald statement. He had heard the words, but he couldn't seem to get the sense of them. What do you mean she's dead? What are you talking about?
And then, as an afterthought,
who's going to bury her?
For although Ruthie's father, Louis's uncle, was an undertaker, he couldn't imagine that Uncle Carl would possibly be the one to do it. In his confusion and mounting fear, he had seized upon this as the most important question. It was a genuine conundrum, like who cut the town barber's hair.
I imagine that Donnie Donahue will do it, his mother replied.
Her eyes were red-rimmed. Most of all, she had looked tired. His mother had looked almost ill with weariness.
He's your uncle's best pal in the business. Oh, but Louis, sweet little Ruthie, I can't stand to think she suffered. Pray with me, will you, Louis? Pray with me for Ruthie. I need you to help me.
So they had gotten down on their knees in the kitchen, he and his mother, and they prayed. and it was the praying that finally brought it home to him. If his mother was praying for Ruthie Creed's soul, then it meant that her body was gone.